Nicole Brandon, and welcome to Unlimited Life. It's so wonderful to be here today, and I actually have one of my very favorite people on the planet as my guest today, so I'm so thrilled for today's show. Last weekend, I was not with you. I was at the PAX workshops with Allison Armstrong, and Allison's work is just incredible. As far as relationships between men and women and relationships with ourselves, she really is the very best in her field. She's like the cherry on the sundae. She is the pinnacle of the pinnacle. And the information was just astounding. And so what we did last week is we had a replay of Paul Sheely's photo reading show for you. And Paul Sheely, to me, is such an incredible genius. I truly believe that in our lifetime and in the future of history, you will hear of Paul Sheely as the same way we talk about Albert Einstein or Galileo or Newton. He is someone that is changing the face of the way that we understand science, technology, the human instinct, our mind, our consciousness, the way we think, the way we achieve things. And if you have not heard Paul Sheely's show, please, for yourself, it's the greatest gift in the world. Listen to him and find his work and material. He truly is fantastic. And I just felt so wonderful knowing that that's what you were hearing last weekend. And then now I am so thrilled for our guest today. Today we are talking with Shelley Wizen. And Shelley Wizen is a speaker. She's a workshop facilitator. She's a CEO. And she is the founder of Soul Diving Institute. I love just saying that, Soul Diving Institute. It makes you think about going into yourself into a whole different way. And she established this to explore and to study and to teach the art and the science of being human from the soul's perspective. And she teaches people how to live consciously, authentically, and she empowers them to have really heart-driven lives. And she teaches them to celebrate the fulfillment of their soul. She is so incredible. When I was looking at her website, I was reading her testimonials, and it's truly the first time that I've ever read a testimonial page where I started to cry, and I was crying from joy because she's touched people in such profound, deep, beautiful ways, and the way that people express their gratitude towards her is so beautiful, not like I've ever seen with anybody. And she just has this incredibly deep impact and effect on people's lives. And I'm so thrilled that she's going to be talking with us today. Her ongoing passion of embracing conscious living and conscious dying led her to study the human spiritual relationships for 40 years with masters throughout the world. And when you talk to her about her journey, it's hysterical, it's enlightening, it's heartwarming, it's enriching, but mostly it's awakening. She has spent over 18 years in the nonprofit world. She has this incredible heart. And she currently serves on the board of directors for LA Hospice at Anam Cara, and she assists Sacred Crossings in creating funeral homes and trains volunteers through the Twilight Brigade, which we're going to talk about today. The Twilight Brigade is such an amazing organization, and the work that they do and the work that she's training people to do is something that each and every one of us could really use in our lives and with our families, with our loved ones. And it's a training organization that educates people on how to be with individuals who are dying. And it's usually not a subject we want to talk about, but we all have people in our lives that cross over. Ourselves, we're going to cross over. And how we deal with those moments in time, how we deal with that transition, really causes pause and effect and changes our lives forevermore. And also the relationships that we have on the other side. So the fact that she's doing this is such a beautiful thing. She's certified in various techniques of coaching. She has incorporated her intuitive skills as a whole life coach and beyond, guiding and educating and mentoring individuals, families, groups, both personally and professionally, and she guides them through life's transitions. And she takes every transition as a healing journey, and she helps people navigate their experience. And she's a dream building coach, and she takes people through dream visioning and a process to attain living the life that they love. But really, her lifelong calling, and you know this in the instant that you see her and you meet her. If I did not tell you this or read a bio and you just happen to run into her on the street, at a red light, at a supermarket, if you run into her, whatever it was, and you looked into her face and into her eyes, I wouldn't have to read a bio to tell you that her lifelong calling is to help others be in joyous lives. There is, it's such a deep heart connection when you see her, and when she looks at you, it's like she's reading your soul in such a beautiful way that you can't help but smile. The same way that when you see a baby smile, you smile back, or the same way when you see something precious and beautiful, if it's a rainbow, if it's just whatever it is, it touches you in such a way that your heart opens and you immediately find joy within yourself and the world. Her presence does that. It's remarkable, and it's beautiful, and it's life-changing for every person she touches. So she is just, she's so incredible, and I can spend days talking about her and accolades and her bio, and as we talk to her, I'll unfold more. But she is just the most amazing, loving, giving, enriching, wise, courageous, special human being. And I'm thrilled that she's with us today. And I want to welcome her to the show. And you're in for such a treat. Shelley, welcome to Unlimited Life.
Oh, my God. That sounded like, I mean, I have never, and I'm sitting here crying just from her introduction. That is so sweet. Thank you, Nicole. It is such a joy and such an honor to be with you, sitting here talking with you.
It's
being in this world.
This is such a beautiful journey, and I know that we're going to talk about the Light Brigade today and crossing over, but I want to talk a little bit about your journey, because I think your journey is so special. One of the things I love to ask people on this show, because I'm always so intrigued, is that when people are little, when they're 6 and 7, and they want to be astronauts or movie stars or Miss America or whatever that is, firemen, did you know, was it instinctive for you as a little girl to help people?
Absolutely. That was like, when I was young, they had these commercials. Now they have them for different countries, but Biafra was one of the countries that they would show these malnutrition children. And I remember being a little girl and watching those and just crying my eyes out and thinking, oh, my God, how could we let people starve in this world? It just didn't make any sense to me. And just in my own family, it was a way to find the soul in people's lives. And I grew up in a house that wasn't the happiest house on the block. So I just knew there was another way for everything that we did in life. It just felt like something else was a reality other than what we just physically saw and felt with our 5 senses. So I knew there was a way to reach out. I just wanted to touch people's hearts. Put a smile on their face, you know.
Well, you certainly do that. You know, that's the thing. There's something about your presence. And there are sometimes you meet people in your life that they don't have to do anything. Just seeing them in the room, just looking at them brings you joy, brings you happiness. And you have this energy that just makes people feel warm and centered and present and wonderful and fulfilled and elated just because you're there, just because you're in front of them, because you're in the room, because you showed up. Just there's something so remarkable. And how you've now taken that and going through your dream building training and all of the life skill coaching that you do and all of the incredible people that you've helped along the way, and now it's almost like there is no end of the road, because now you're stepping over the line of this lifetime into the next lifetime. And so you're just going beyond and beyond. It's, you know, you're going beyond Oz. The golden
maybe that's,
road
what, that's what the beyond means, right?
So,
I know.
So tell me a little bit. I mean, I was reading your bio, and you were a yoga instructor and a life coach, and so tell me a little bit about you know, your journey, and then we definitely want to talk about the what you're doing now and this amazing organization that's just helping people worldwide.
Well, when I was young, as I said, I was a seeker from the very beginning. I think part of it was a survival mechanism, and I feel very blessed and grateful that I was given something to be able to get through a childhood that wasn't very easy with a kind of a mom who was not well and mentally, and it was challenging, five kids, and it was challenging, I must say. And I got interested in this other realm of reality. And when I was about, well, very young, but when I really started understanding that there were some books that I could read, I came across, I'm not sure in which order this came, but the books that sent out were Illusion, Siddhartha, and There is a River. And it was, There is a River was about Edgar Casey's life and how as a child they all thought he was slow, and then one day he put himself in a trance and took a nap and woke up. He had a book on his chest and he woke up and he was able to recite everything that was in that book. And then he had this innate ability to be able to diagnose people's illnesses from like on the other side of the world, and he could see it with his inner vision. And that just fascinated the hell out of me. Fascinated me, and I wanted to learn more. I was like this hungry student of life that just wanted to grasp onto every ounce of information and knowledge and wisdom that I could find. And Siddhartha really did it, and that was another book that just impacted my life so much. And at 15, you know, he went to his father, and his father said, "Son, you are a man now, and you will go find your way in life, and whatever path that is will be your path." And I'm thinking, I'm crying, reading that, thinking, oh, I wish he was my father. And what a beautiful thing for a father to recognize in their child that it's their journey and their path, and to even talk on that level. It was like, I think as a child, I just longed for that so much because and God didn't really exist in my house. I always felt like he skipped over it. And then being brought up in a Jewish life, we had five kids. My mother would dress us up on high holidays. We all looked like this beautiful, happy family. Came home, it was like, boy, my God, it's not like that on the outside. So it was that to deal with, you know, and I was just hungry for families that got along. And, I mean, I've talked to you, Nicole, and some of the things you shared with me about your family growing up is just like a fairy tale to me, absolute fairy tale, that love and support. And, I mean, I first of all, thank you so much for wanting to even talk with me and share my vision and my journey and with other people. It just touches me deeply, deeply, deeply. And you are just an astounding young woman on this planet. And I just feel so blessed to be in your life and you be in mine and be on this journey together. And before I got along too far in my journey, I just want to say you are such a huge part of my journey, such a huge part. And
you're so blessed.
Yeah.
And truly, it's such, sometimes there's just such a magic kindred connection between people. And I think that one of the things that we found when we, you know, the first time that we met is that our desire is so great and so grand to help so many people.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I feel like Mother Teresa's sister.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
I feel like, you know, I'm God's brother. Like, whatever that is. I think that for me, it's I have this insatiable urge to learn more so I can learn more, so I can share more with other people and help other people in a higher, more profound way.
I am so right with you. I know. That's the one thing I saw immediately in you. And I was so struck and touched deeply in my heart and my soul just by our first acquaintance. When I looked into your eyes, I could just see your soul. It was so big and so beautiful and so present is what I want to say. And you know, navigating this human experience, having that great of a soul in a human body, which is pretty unlimiting, was astounding to me. And I just wanted to hold you and just let you feel the love that I have for you and your soul and what its greatest desire is to do in this world at this time. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I had that as a child, and I thought I was Florence Nightingale. I mean, you know, I wanted to save all. When I went to Israel, I mean, oh, my God, I picked a kibbutz. You know, I bought a one-way ticket to Europe when I was 19 and hitchhiked in Europe for 6 months. And, boy, if that doesn't build trust in one's being, I don't know what. And I went to Morocco, and I met this family and this guy who led me to his father out in the middle of the desert who looked just like Siddhartha. And I thought, oh, my God. Because he told me that his father, when he was 14, his father took him aside and said, son, you are a man now. I mean, it was just like what Siddhartha told and was told. And we went to the middle of the desert, and I met his father. I mean, the most incredible adventures that this human being called Shelley has taken me on. And I always look down at my feet to see where my feet are planted, to see where the hell I am, because I've just been so blessed with these incredible teachings and exposure to different masters, to different cultures, to my neighbor, to the person in the grocery store. I mean, every single person has a soul that sparkles. And what I say is look for that sparkle. And you can have intimacy with someone in a split second. You don't have to wait 6 months to be vulnerable or reopen. You can have it the moment you lay eyes on someone. All you have to do is be willing to go there and want to. So that's kind of been the driving force behind me and reading all those books. And then I started taking different courses where I took this course called Mind Psybiotics, and it taught how to use your peripheral vision to be aware. I think they call it it's a visual awareness. You know what I'm talking about, where you put your attention to your periphery, and then you have this total awareness all around you. A lot of speakers use it to bring in the group. And so I did a lot of exercises using crystals and this and that to learn how to listen with that periphery focus, because then you're really taking in someone on a neutral level, and you're not listening. If you lean forward, you're not listening to project something, or if you lean back, you're not listening and thinking about your own past and what they're saying, and you just learn to listen objectively, you know, at all possible. And then I lived in Israel, and I was told that I went to this kibbutz agency when I was 19, and I was told there was a kibbutz that desperately needed girl volunteers. And I'm like, oh, my chance to be Florence Nightingale. Yay, it's here. I'm going out to the field, and I'm going to help the soldiers. I mean, I'm telling you, it was all that. And then I ended up being on a kibbutz, where it's located right on the border of Jordan and Israel, and there was bombing and shooting, and I got hit with shrapnel from a Katyusha rocket, and I'm telling you, it was just amazing, just the most amazing experiences. And it was a journey of discovery, and my focus has always been on the soul's perspective, because there's something that lives in this human body that's just, you know, that's physically limited in what we know of what the word limitation means. Does that make any sense?
Oh, absolutely it does.
Yeah.
I mean, because for me, you know, I live in a limited form. And when, you know, for myself, when I was growing up, I was on the high wire trapeze. I was on the balance beam, and I would take away all the mats under the balance beam because I thought if there are no mats under the beam, I'm not going anywhere except back on that beam, and I would jump off cliffs into raging oceans. To me, there was never any limitation, and what amazed me was that other people had it wasn't the way that I lived. It was amazing to me that other people were afraid to do a cartwheel, or that people are afraid to go down a mountain on skis, or that, you know, other fears or phobias of it amazed me that people are afraid to love amazes yeah. me, or trust, or have faith,
yeah.
or believe,
right. or even
or
look.
Make a wish when they blow out their birthday
yeah.
candles.
Yeah.
I mean, it,
yeah.
the fact that how other people have limitations and lines is the amazing part. Not living unlimited. Living unlimited is what we came here to do, is to have
right.
this physical experience, this unlimited experience in a human form. And so I love that that's where your, you know, passion and that your soul rang that bell and knew that instinctively.
Yeah. Yeah. I have taken myself to those places, and I too have let myself go to a camp and jump off cliffs into water, you know, hike up cliffs and rappel a 2,000-foot mountain, jump off a cliff in a parasail. You know, I mean, all of that kind of stuff has enriched my life so much and has given me the ability to understand what the word brave means. And even to look inside of ourselves, I think one needs to be brave. Because most, what I find is most of us live on the surface of that physical realm, and we think that's what's real. And so we stay on the surface of our own being because that's what we're conditioned to do. And we don't let ourselves dive. And that's why I call it soul diving, because it's a journey. I mean, I'm a scuba diver. And so when we go down into the water, it's a discovery. And you need to prepare yourself for that discovery. You need to make an intention, and you need to make sure that your oxygen equipment is working properly and your regulator's working and all of that. You need to be mindful. You need to go down slow. You need to come up slow. And the discoveries you find under that water is just magical. And I find the same with soul diving. And in a way, for so many years, I kind of hid it. I hid my passion and my love for diving into the soul. And now I've kind of come out of the closet.
You know, it's funny that you compare it to scuba diving, because the first time that I was diving, I had a couple things happen. One was that there were colors that I did not know existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw and I witnessed colors
yeah. Yeah.
that were beyond anything my mind and the
yeah.
wheel and color spectrum had ever had a place for before.
Yeah.
And it was so magnificent to see that there was something even richer or more beautiful than I ever imagined.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
the other thing was, I kept thinking, why didn't I do this earlier?
Yeah.
If I knew it was this wonderful and this rich and this lush and this
yeah.
exotic and this magical and magnificent, I would have done this years ago.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
is it the same when people are soul diving? Do they say, I've seen things I've never seen before, and also
yes.
if I knew it was going to be this, I would have done this years
absolutely.
Ago?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's changing our perception. It's changing our perspective in the way in which we think, in the way in which we see, the way in which we hear, the way in which we speak, the language with which we use. It's all of it. It's really being heartful and soulful about one's existence in this human experience. Because it's easy to be caught up in the physical world, because we see it, we feel it, we touch it, we touch ourselves, there's a boundary that we can feel. I'm clapping my hands right now, and I can feel the boundary between both hands. I can feel a pressure. And because we're in this form called a body, we think that's all there is. We see the leaves, we see the flowers. I'm sitting at Tony's house in her dining room and looking out on the backyard, and there's this fuchsia. Excuse me, I've been sick. This fuchsia, a bougainvillea, that is just stunning. I know you've seen that one, Nicole. And it's beautiful. And so what happens is what we see sometimes affects how we are. And sometimes what we do is we let that spill into our conditions and our circumstances, and what people say and how they say it. Because what happens is we begin to live from the outside in rather than the inside out. And because we start letting those things that are outside of us dictate how we feel, we start recognizing that we may be feeling a little more bad than we'd like to, a little more negative than we'd like to, but we don't really know the tools of how to make that any different. We just take it for granted that that's part of our living experience, that it just has to be that way because most of us have been conditioned to think so. And so the whole notion about soul diving and going in and going deep, it's like that scuba diving. That's a great analogy that you use because we're on an earth and we have something and we want to dive into it. Well, we're like our own earth. And when we dive within ourselves, we find things about ourselves and about life that we may not have taken notice of before. That whenever we have an aha moment, I mean, to me, that's the most incredible moment in life is when somebody says to me after I've given them a perspective or asked them a question, they say, gosh, I never thought of it that way. That's all I love to do is to tweak that land of possibility, just the possibility that it could be that way.
Okay,
doesn't
then
mean
I have
it
a question,
is.
And I love that.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you're saying it the way that you're saying it. So you say when people come to you and you're giving them another perspective. So when do people come to you? Does somebody come to you because they're saying, oh, my gosh, my life is not working. I keep banging into walls. My body is completely bruised because every time I turn around, I think there's an open door, and all of a sudden I'm like the weevil who wobbles, and I'm down again, and I get back up.
Yeah.
Or do people come to you when their life is rich and fulfilled and they're thinking, can there possibly even be more than this magical ride and world I'm living? So at what point does somebody find you for coaching, and does somebody want to look deeper into their soul and the infinite possibilities of their world and life?
All of the above, Nicole, all of the above, because it's interesting because I've struggled for a while to find a title of myself, but I still haven't quite found it. I think the most accurate is a master soul diver, because that I can do. You know, if you ask me, well, what are my skills? That's something I can do. It's something that comes natural to me to be able to hold the space for other people to dive into their own soul and have their own experience. And I love to empower them in a way where they just consider a possibility that's different than the one they've considered. That's all. Just consider it. Because I don't pretend to have the answers in capital T-H-E. You know, I don't. I can only offer my life's experience in this being called Shelley and all the multitude of experiences that I've had that form who I am today. And it's so joyful to me to be able to hold that space. That's one of the reasons I love to train and teach the Twilight Brigade stuff. Or any workshop, you know, I've created a workshop called Being Human from the Soul's Perspective. I didn't know if anybody would remotely be interested in that, to tell you the truth. I'm telling you, I'm kind of like a newbie because I'm just coming out of the closet and admitting that I'm a soul diver. And I'm looking for my fellow soul divers. So whether you're going through something joyous, and you want to know, wonder if there's more. To me, it's anything that celebrates the fulfillment of the soul. Because at the end of life, and that's another reason I love to coach people at the end of life, is because the fulfillment of the soul is what matters at the end of life. So why not start now? Why wait till the end of life to feel the fulfillment of the soul? Because during our lifetime, when we get caught up in the physical, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's really more about the ego of the human experience. And we please the ego, and we serve the ego, and we get dressed. And I'm not saying we don't all stay in a way vain, but it's a different kind of vanity when we get up and we put on our clothes and put on makeup or we go to school, you know, we do this and we want to be cute, we want to be this. And there's a different sense about who we are when we're dying. When we're dying, it's not about how we look. It can't be. So it's almost there's a shift that happens to a certain portion of our life where we service the ego to a certain degree. But the heart is the connection between the ego and the soul. And so at the end of life, our job is to really service the soul. I mean, you know, we know when people are dying, let's face it, most people that are sick, if they're dying, they don't look what we think is at their best. And we don't even think we look at our best. In fact, there's a lot of shame involved when we become sick and dying because we don't look the way we used to look. Our whole identity was wrapped around this human being, ego, you know, productive, you know, conscious, active human being, which is no longer the same form. The form even changes in this lifetime. We don't even really wait till the next lifetime to change form, because here's the way I look at life and birth and death. It's, first of all, one bit of information that I learned that I just love this piece of information that's given me so much, that is there are some seeds in a forest that will only pop at 1400 degrees temperature. They will only open at that high degree of temperature. And so that when we have forest fires, that's how the forest fire reforests the forest. Is all those new seedlings have been given the opportunity to pop and grow into the earth. So I look at our bodies like a seed. And when our spirit, and here's another piece of information that I've learned. There's so much information I don't know, but there are little pieces that I've learned that just stay with me, you know. And that is that in science we know that energy expands. It also contracts. But the universe is expanding. Wouldn't you say that so, Nicole?
Yes.
Is that
absolutely
what you've learned also?
Yes. Well, you feel it. I mean, some days, when you look at pictures of all the commercials, of whether it be for vitamins or shampoo or whatever it is, cereal, people get out of bed and they stretch their arms wide in the air.
Right.
And there is this expansion, or when people reach
that's
up
right.
to the sun, or that's as a right. child, where I always loved the cartwheel because it was like the sky, the
right.
earth, the
Me
sky,
too.
The earth, the sky, the earth, and that connection to that expansion. But there's absolutely
right.
that expansion happening now.
Right. And so spirit, when we look at energy, and I kind of interchange energy with spirit, when spirit expands so much so, this is my theory or belief or whatever, my perspective, my perception, whatever, is that, and it can no longer contain the body. So it goes beyond the body. So the body breaks down in order for the spirit to be free. Just like that pod, that seed that breaks open at 1400 degree temperature. And so what happens is the spirit expands. It leaves the body, it just keeps expanding, and the body goes back to the earth or whatever. It sheds it just like the shell of the seed. It becomes part of the earth again, and then something else happens. And so I find, interestingly enough, that when people are facing the end of their life, when I give them that analogy or that visual, it seems to comfort people because it feels like that their life mattered, like it was okay that their body broke down. I mean, I must say that one of the things that disturbs me a little bit, and I don't really get disturbed too much, and not I don't mean disturbed in a bad way either, because that's a whole other theory of the theory of perturbation, which I could talk about.
Yes, I love that's one of my favorite subjects, actually.
Oh,
yes,
I love
the stone into the pond and the ripples. Yes.
My God, and things have to be perturbed in order to grow. I mean, all of that I love. But now I just lost my thought. Oh, the whole concept of
people are at their end of their life, and you were saying that, you know, when they're shedding their skin, flower is growing, and that when people feel that they don't look their best, or people
because, oh, I know what it was, the disturbing. When people say, and I know they don't mean this, but that's another reason why I'm a big language catcher, because language sets up thought, and it's kind of vice versa. When people say they lost the battle and died, it makes us feel like we've done something wrong. Why did we, like they were weak? When somebody said, oh, they lost the battle to cancer and died. It's like, oh, they couldn't fight hard enough? No. We each have our soul's journey. We each are going to go in the way we go. And if it's necessary for the body to break down in order for the spirit to be free, then it just chooses that way or chooses that way or getting hit by a truck or, I mean, we're all going one way or another. We can go kicking and screaming or we can go with a...
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but as you're saying, we're all going, and I don't think there's anybody that's listening to this show or that will listen to this show, and as people download this and they're listening, you know, and they're on the bicycle, little treadmills, and they're in their car, and they're meditating, and we hear that everybody's going to go, and we're like, everybody's going to go, and our animals are going to go, and our parents, and our children, and our loved ones, yet we are so afraid of this subject.
Yeah.
You know, even as you talk about the Twilight Brigade and people being certified in this work or learning this work, why do you think people are so afraid to even talk about death and dying?
I know. Well, first of all, our society is deathophobic. And the minute you even use the D word, you know, it's like they put a cross in front of you with their fingers, like you're the angel of death and don't talk to me about that, because if you talk to me about it, it means it's going to happen. Well,
but
it is going to happen.
But how can we be deathophobic when we have movies where people are being shot and run over and thrown off cliffs and monsters that eat people and tear people apart? How do we become a deathophobic society?
Exactly. We actually dramatize it, but when it comes to personalizing it, it's okay to watch it in a movie and see it out there. But if we actually personalize it and talk about what we personally feel about it, now you're getting into some touchy subject, you know. So I know with the Twilight Brigade training, and it's a 3-day, 20-hour training that you just don't miss 1 minute of it, it holds the space for people to grapple with the subject. And because we don't often take the time, it's certainly not cocktail conversation. Although a friend of mine, Laura Lewis, she does these wonderful, you might want to talk to her one day. There's a lot of people in this field that are coming forth, and one of the things that I sensed years ago was that we were creating a field and that there's a movement. There's a definite movement about a conscious dying, end-of-life field, because there are more and more practitioners in different aspects of this that are coming forth. And it's a beautiful thing, and I feel like I'm part of a movement. And that's another responsibility I feel, is to go out and talk about that so that people aren't afraid. My goal would be to alleviate that fear. And I'm not saying I could alleviate anything in anybody, but to at least offer, again, a perspective that maybe within themselves they would alleviate some of that fear because they'd see it in a different light, in a different perspective. Because I believe that when you're truly conscious of dying, and that's some of the training that I've had as well, we really, really become conscious of living. And then we don't have to live the rest of our life with the fear. We can deal with it now. It's like on a on a first date. I mean, you might want to ask some deep questions on a first date. Why wait? You know? Why wait to find out what the person is like?
It's so funny that you say that, because I went to an event the other night, and it was a post-party for Sundance. Fabulous, fabulous event. Creative, wonderful, loving, enthusiastic people. And I happened to meet some people that were reality show producers. And fun, wonderful, talented, brilliant. But they started asking me questions that you don't usually ask people when you first meet them. And I finally said, are we dating? Are we like, these are such personal questions.
Oh, that's funny.
But they're reality producers. So they go right for the jugular. They want information.
Right.
They, you know, that's what they do.
Right.
And it was so new for me to have somebody ask these questions. But what if we could? What if we were comfortable? You know, we had Brent Bajorzin on the Hourglass Bride Show, and he's an estate planner. And he was talking about when people get married. They should talk about estate planning. They should talk about
wills.
They should talk, you know, but most people wait until they've been married 20 years to say, okay, we should have this uncomfortable conversation.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. I say nip it in the bud, find out now, and deal with it, because then you have that many more years ahead of you to live a life that you love living without that dread of whatever dread it is we create in our head, because it's all made up anyway. We might as well make it up the way we want it to be.
Okay, so then...
At least in our mind.
Sure. You're talking about something called the Twilight Brigade. And so we have a whole bunch of people on this call all over the world that have no idea what the Twilight Brigade is. And it's something that everybody should know about. So can you share a little bit about the organization and the work?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I was drawn to the Twilight Brigade because of the work that it does and the training that it held to. It was created, I didn't know this part when I joined it, because I just went for the work part. But it was actually created by a man by the name of Danion Brinkley. Some people on this call might know who he is. He was struck by lightning, and he was dead for 28 minutes and came back to life, and was given a whole lot of information from the other side that he had to share with this side. Because being a military man, he had this huge compassion for his fellow veterans who were coming back from wherever they were stationed with post-traumatic stress syndrome, watching their lives fall apart, watching how they became estranged from their families, and watching how they would die alone, especially in veterans' hospitals where they were and didn't have people to come and visit them. So he was doing a project with AIDS called Project Nightlife with Marianne Williamson years ago. And then that evolved into something else, and then he created the Twilight Brigade. At that time, it was called Compassion in Action, and that was in 1997. And so... some of the people that come to the Twilight Brigade training are, they call them Danionites, because he's a huge presence, a big, huge spirit who's from South Carolina, and he just comes out and says this and that and doesn't care. He's just big, and he's great. He's a great energy and a great spirit, and he wanted to create an educational institute where they would train volunteers how to be with veterans who were dying. And over the years, they have created a curriculum for that weekend with it. I won't even say one word about the training itself, because part of going into this training is not knowing. And that's part of the lesson of going into death, is not knowing. So the whole notion of you're just going to jump into this training, a three-day training, and not knowing what it is you're going to experience is part of the process. And all I can say is it's a life-changing, truly life-changing experience. And one of the greatest joys that I get is to see somebody walking in with a bit of hesitation a bit of resistance, but a huge amount of curiosity, and leaving a totally deeper and different person. And their experience as a human being is different. And so I think over the years there have been at least 5,000 people trained, 6,000 people trained throughout the country. We have several chapters in different parts of the country. The LA chapter is a growing chapter now. We have trainings 4 times a year. This coming training, March 21st to 23rd, totally booked. I'm like, wow, something's happening because it's totally booked and has been for about a month. So we added another training May 29th through June 1st, another one August 29th through the 31st, and November 21st through the 23rd. And we have about, we limit the size. I want it to be a very intimate experience for people. So when you have it, I mean, you could have it big, but I like to have no more than maybe 30, 36 people. And, it's a beautiful journey. And so people volunteer at the VA, they mentor, they shadow the people who've done it. Danny himself has been awarded, 69,000 bedside hours he's had. He's just an amazing man. He's been doing this for over 35 years. Comparatively, I'm fairly new in this field, but I'm going to take a deep breath here. It is such a privilege, and I don't know if anyone has ever been with somebody who has died in that moment, but what I want to say is it's one of the biggest privileges and such a gift to be able to witness and hold the space for that being to go. And the first time I had that experience, I felt like a midwife. And I thought to myself, you know, we sit and we wait for a spirit to be born through a baby with patience, kindness, compassion. It's the same at the end because the body goes through labor. It's not easy to die sometimes. It's kind of laborious and laborious. Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of work. It takes not eating, it takes not drinking, it takes shutting down. You know, it depends on what kind of illness, but, you know, there are certain similarities in the process of dying when you get into what's called the active state of dying. And in that last moment, it's like a miracle that we get to witness of seeing the spirit move on out of the body. And I don't know, I just get so much out of it, and I know Dan, and he gets more out of that practically than living relationships. He says, I love to be with dying people because I can relate to them. I say, don't be afraid. There's some beauty on the other side. He throws humor in there, and I throw humor in there because, you know, life sometimes is so absurd. It just gets absurd. So
it's so amazing. Now, who should take this class? Is this class for someone whose family and friends are dying, or someone who's dying themselves, or should everybody take this class to be able to, for themselves,
everybody,
and for those that they love?
Every single person that breathes takes this class. And yes, you will learn along the way some things about veterans. Maybe that's not your level of interest. But certainly you must know someone who's dying, or someone who knows someone who's dying, or some loved one. And I mean, we don't know how to behave around someone who's dying. We don't know how to talk to them. Most of the time you stand in a room and you're talking about them in front of them as if they're not even there anymore. And we just don't know. We don't know how to behave. We don't know what to say. If someone is conscious, we don't even know how to talk to them. So these are some tools that you get to learn, called active listening tools and other kinds of ways to bond and hold the space for someone to feel safe. Because that's, in the end, that's really what we want. We want to feel safe. We want to feel loved. We want to feel okay. We want to feel like it's okay. And most of the time, we're not. In hospitals, you know, I think the statistics are astounding. I think it's 70%, it could be higher, but 70% of medical expenses are spent in the last 6 months trying to keep someone alive, and the average age of keeping them alive is 16 more.
That's, you know, it's interesting that you talk about that, because I went to an incredible workshop at the Writers Guild called Compassion Care, and
okay.
they were talking about the rights of people that are dying in hospitals, and they were saying that, you know, you have the right not to be weighed. Like, you don't
right.
have to wake people that are dying. You don't have to wake somebody
right.
up to give them medication who's finally comfortable
that's
and
right.
asleep. That liquid
that's
food
right.
is not food. That if you want a corned beef sandwich and it's going to add 2 hours to your life, you know,
that's
or when
right.
people have a choice
that's right.
to eat what they want, to sleep, to not
that's
be
right.
jostled, and that you actually have, you know, rights. And
that's right.
Just
we teach what those rights are as well. That's right.
Yeah.
yeah. And we think we're supposed to do everything we possibly can to save their life. Well, there comes a time when there's a word called dignity. There's a concept called honor. There's an embrace called grace. And, I mean, I realized in the very first experience. Do we have time for me to share this little story?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
We do have great on time.
Okay. The very first time that I was exposed to being with someone who was dying was, and this is how I found my life's calling, was a friend of mine who was 62 years old was dying of leukemia. She was this wonderfully courageous woman who got married for the second time, I think it was, to a man who already had children, and she had not had children. And she was 41 when she got married to him, and he had older children. And she wanted to have a baby. And so he did a reverse vasectomy, and she got pregnant at 47 years old and had a baby. And I was there at the birth. So this is the same woman who was dying of leukemia. And she asked me to move into her home with her, her husband, and her son, who was then 15, to help relieve her husband, because they did not have hospice. That's a whole other word that carries a stigma to some people in this country. And it did to them, and it did to me actually then, because I kind of went along with it because I didn't really know what hospice was. So it was me, the housekeeper, her husband, her son, and a couple of his family members that came to visit. And I took her to chemo, and I took her to radiation and all of this business during this time. And one day, I remember, after her chemo treatment, she wanted to go to the movies. So I called her husband and said, her other girlfriend and I, Sandy, are going to take her to the movies. And he said, you can't take her to the movies. She's sick. She's got to go home in bed. I said, Jerry, what's going to happen? She's going to die? Can't she die in the middle of a movie the way she wants to see it? This is her life now. She wants to go to the movies. And they would always bicker with each other, God bless them. I have to say, he was so gracious in allowing me to be in that intimate circle with my friend and his wife. And I was there every single step of the way, serving as their life coach and helping them to navigate this experience and teaching them to be the eye of the storm, to hold the experience with the greatest of regard as a sacred experience, not something horrible, but something beautiful, and to hold that experience for her. And with that, the whole intention of the house and the whole ambiance and feeling of the house changed. And we also told everybody who walked into the door. Same thing that we did with Jean, if you remember, Nicole.
Yes.
And if you had fear, you just check it at the door. You could pick it up on your way out, but not to bring it into the home. So we took her to the movies, and I took her to a movie that she never in her life would have seen. She was very serious, although she had one of the funniest senses of humor I ever heard. But she liked the book clubs and the lectures and the opera. She was very cultured, and she loved serious kind of movies, thoughtful and all that. Well, I took her to see Confessions of a Shopaholic. And I have got to tell you, and she goes, I said, I'm going to take you to a movie that you would not normally go to. And we did. And she ate a half a sandwich, which was huge for her at the time. And she had a blast. Took her home. She went to bed, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Fast forward about 3 weeks. Well, she wanted to find every cure there was known to mankind. And Jerry, her husband, had the wherewithal and the financial wherewithal to hire people that would go on the internet around the world to see what was the latest and the greatest. And she was being cared for at the City of Hope in greatest of hands. And excuse me. And they didn't find anything. Well, she wanted to fight. He knew, and the doctor knew, that it was just a matter of a little bit of time. Nobody really knew what that time was, but you know. So anyway, come 3 weeks later on a Monday, we went to the City of Hope, and she said to the doctor, and this was the first time she had said this, that's it, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. The doctor started crying. I started crying. Jerry started crying. And it was the most moving, touching moment. And the doctor said, I am so sorry. I did whatever I could. And Susan, in her New Jersey voice, said, don't. Well, needless to say, we got in the car. She was in the back seat. And Susan didn't have any sisters. So she formed this little group called her sisters of about 8 women from different walks of life. And she was the glue that kept us all together. And we would, upon occasion, gather together for her and had a beautiful time. So on the way home from the doctor, I said to her, Susan, let's have a gathering of your sisters. Let's have it on Wednesday. This was on a Monday. Let's have it on Wednesday.
No, we can't have it on Wednesday. Kathy works and she won't be able to come. She's got clients. Let's have it on Friday.
What if you die on Friday? She goes, huh, am I going to die on Friday? I said, well, I don't know if you're going to die, but wouldn't you feel bad if you didn't have the gathering on Wednesday and you had it on Friday and you died on Friday?
She goes, okay, we'll see if they'll come.
I said, look, if people can drop what they do, and this is a hint for everybody out there, if people can drop whatever they do to go to a funeral, you can damn well sure they're going to drop whatever they are doing to go to a gathering before someone dies, to see them actually before they go. I got home. Within 20 minutes, all women were signed up for this gathering, 8 women. One flew in from Kansas for the morning and left the afternoon. I told everybody to bring a trinket or something small that belonged to them that they could give to her so she could put it in her coffin. Each person brought something. We made her dining room beautiful. She lived in Beverly Hills. She had this beautiful home, this beautiful dining room, and we dressed it up like just beautiful, like she would love it. Each person came and brought their little trinket, and they either sat with her individually. She was in a wheelchair. She was just coherent enough to be able to hear everything everybody said. They sat with her, told her how much they loved her, how much they were going to miss her, and how much she gave to them, how much she mattered, how much she was loved and appreciated and recognized. And it in itself gave the people, the sisters, so much healing that they in themselves were ready to hold the space for her to go in a beautiful way and not in a horrible way. So, yes, there was a healing for her. There was a healing for them. Well, that was the last day she got out of bed because she died on Saturday. And even the dying experience was just amazing. Her husband had an appointment, and I was there with her in the bedroom. And she was unconscious at this time, and I played beautiful music. I have these CDs that I play, and I whisper. We used to practice, by the way, during this four-week period. I would take her on guided meditations and let her practice letting her spirit leave her body to see what it felt like so she wouldn't be afraid when it happened. And that was a fun journey.
That's amazing. That's great.
Yeah, that was really fun. And she had a patch that she needed to wear over her eye. And we would play Peter Pan and Captain Hook with the patch. And sometimes we'd put the patch in the middle of third eye. You know, we just would laugh and joke and just have the most amazing time in spite of what was going on physically. So at this time she was unconscious, and he said, okay, just keep everything quiet, keep the curtains closed. And she had this beautiful bedroom with this beautiful bed and these curtains that were on remote control. And she was lying in the bed. It was very dark, and behind the curtain was this bay window full of light, light, light. And I was behind the curtain doing homework. I was taking a course at the time, and I would open the curtain. I kind of felt like the Wizard of Oz opening the curtain, see how she was doing. And then I was standing on the other side of the curtain. I realized, you know what? If today is the day she's going to die, she's not going in the dark. She's going in the light. So I went in. I took that remote control. I opened up the curtains, and light flooded the room. I thought, why does she have to go in the dark? I flooded the room. I put on this beautiful music. I sprayed this scent, which is one of my favorite scents that she loved to, called Rain. And here was this beautiful, soulful music playing. I sprayed the rain because, oh, hearing is the last sense to go, by the way, and smell is the second to the last sense to go. So I knew she could smell, and I knew she could hear. And then I would just whisper beautiful things in her ear and kind of touch her head and caress her head and just tell her how beautiful she is and what a beautiful human being she has been and how much she's given to each and every one of us and how valued she has been and is and thank you for her life and all of that beautiful stuff. And then at some point during the day, her body released. So everything released into the bed. And I called in the housekeeper, and I said, get a bucket of soapy water and some towels. We're cleaning her up, because I did not want her husband to come home and see her in that way. So we had two housekeepers and me roll her over. I cleaned her tushy. It was the biggest honor.
I felt like I was cleaning a baby.
I'm telling you, I felt I was cleaning a baby. It was the sweetest thing ever. I know it's probably gross for everybody, but anyway, she was also my friend.
It's so beautiful as you talk about as we come in and as we leave, you know, and as
you
know, so much love and holding the space. And I love that you've created this energy and the light and the healing and the humor of her with the doctor and the love the humor of her and the fact, I love, you know, one of the things that just struck me so much is when you're saying people can take off work for a funeral, and they do, and why can't we take off work, you know, to be able to see people on their life. And I was unaware, as I'm sure many of the listeners were unaware of, that hearing, you know, is one of the last to go, and so is a sense of smell. I mean, it's so beautiful, and for us all to have these kind of experiences. And you're so loving, and obviously, you know, what we all hear from this is the care and the intentionality in which you help people cross over. And how do people find the Light Brigade class, and how do people find you as a coach to work with?
Well, it's called thetwilightbrigade.com. That's the national website, and it shows you the different chapters around the country and the trainings and all of that. And so, you know, you can call up and or register online. We're just getting a national system in place where if you're in Washington and you're flying to L.A. and you want to take the training in L.A., you can register online, and that's just been a tremendous help. And so you can do that. As far as me, I'm in under construction for my new website called the Soul Diving Institute, Soul Diving Institute. But you can also look up Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y, Silver, S-I-L-V-E-R, Wizen, W-H-I-Z-I-N. And I have a website now called Whole Life Coaching and Beyond.com. So that's W-H-O-L-E.
And is that the best way for people to contact you to work with you?
They can call me, 818-414-5111, or they can email me, Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y, at S as in Shelley, S as in Silver, Wizin, W-H-I-Z-I-N.com.
The work you do is so extraordinary. And I wanted to, as we're, you know, talking about the end-of-life coaching, just come back to, you know, one of the other things. I know that you do the dream building, the dream world. And can you talk a little bit about your coaching in that aspect as well? Because I also think that's also a wonderful journey for everybody as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for reminding me about that. I discovered a woman who many people already knew for many years, but I didn't, and her name is Mary Morrissey. And she created a Life Solutions company and Life Mastery Institute, where she teaches a course called Dream Builder. And I'm a certified coach in the Dream Builder course. And what I love about it is that it's a structure and a 3-month, 12-week program that one can go through to really go soul diving. It's a way to go soul diving by asking certain questions, listening to her curriculum, her CDs, and going and writing up a worksheet. And I use it as one of my curriculums because it's a structure. It's there. I don't have to reinvent the wheel. Everything she says is what I would say. So I say partner with people that you respect and admire and use each other's work. You know, you don't have to reinvent everything. And so I use her curriculum, and I love it, and clients really get a lot out of it because the whole point in whether you're conscious of dying or conscious of living is the quality of the living that you're doing. Some people have been dead for many years and they're just existing in their body, plodding along, living a condition-based life, thinking that their conditions dictate how they feel, what they do, blah, blah, blah. They're on the wambulance train, you know, crying, wah, wah, wah. And there are tools that we can use to shift our thoughts. And basically, once we have that little tiny possibility that maybe it could be a little different, that you actually could live the life that you love living, that's what really got me. Because the question isn't how do I do something or how could I possibly do that. The question is, would I love to do that? Would that bring me more life? Would I love doing that? Would that make me feel so excited that I would love to do that? Then what happens is you're freeing something inside of your brain, your imagination, and that's basically all we are is our imagination. And I believe that somehow God is our imagination. So that's where we get to co-create, because without our imagination, we're nothing. I mean, every single thing we see starts as a thought. It starts as an idea. And I remember years ago, my favorite thing to say was to manifest thought into form. And I was a designer in another life, and we manifested a beautiful line of bedding that just was high-end beautiful. And when I saw it, I went, wow, we manifested thought into form. Everything we see has to start from an idea, from somebody's dream somewhere. The table, the chair you're sitting on, the glass you're drinking out of, the pattern in the glass, everything we see came from somebody's mind. Everything. So I want to be able to inspire people to know that they can live in a land of possibility and actually live that life that they love living. So I help them do that. I'm like a transition specialist. It kind of doesn't matter what transition you're going through, whether you want to go from here to there. I kind of help you navigate how to do that. And I love that.
I love that you're a transition specialist. And I also wanted to just bring in, since, you know, you mentioned it while we were on the radio, and of course there are people that are listening to this show that are all over the world in so many different countries, and I'm so honored and so blessed to always bring them such incredible information. But at one point you were saying that you're at Tony's looking at the bougainvillea.
Yeah.
And as, you know, we're talking about huge transitions.
Oh,
I would love for you to just talk about Miley's little transition and who Miley is. And people that are listening, because I know that they're saying, who is Tony? And where is she that she's looking at bougainvillea? For the people that are listening in London, Australia, listening to this show, I just wanted to give you a little clue of where Shelley was today, because she's in a really magical place.
You want me to tell her, or do you want to tell her?
Sure, yes, please.
Okay, so I'm sitting at Tony Bua's house right now in Glendale, California. Well, actually, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But anyway, in somewhere in California. And we have a beautiful dog lying next to us. Well, there's a multitude of stories here. I'll start with Miley and weave my way back to Tony. Miley is a husky who was rescued about 2 months ago on a trash heap in downtown Los Angeles. And they, somebody saw her, saw this lump of white sitting on top of a trash pile, and it was moving, and they didn't know what it was, and went closer and saw that it was actually an animal, and the animal was alive, and it was actually a dog and a husky. So they called up the Paws for Hope, I believe, Foundation, and please forgive me if I got that wrong, Eldon. But well, actually, I've got the paper in front of me. So he rescued her, and he took a little video clip of his rescue, as he does to the animals that he rescues. And he put some music to it, and he put it on YouTube. It went viral, and over 13 million people have seen that, Miley the dog. You could just put Miley the dog. So a friend of Tony's, and Tony is a friend of mine of over 30 years. She is an acting teacher. She's a writer, a lyricist. She's an actress, a performer, a singer, a director, a producer, a humanitarian, an angel, a beautiful human being. And I don't think I left anything out there, did I, Nicole?
No, that was perfect. That was exactly everything that was running through my head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so years ago, I helped them to produce a play called Pepper Street. And Pepper Street was based on a class project that stemmed from a young girl. And I don't know if you know this story, Nicole, but one of the girls in our acting class, she was 18 years old. And Tony would always say, so how are you today, Andre? And she would say, fine. And no matter what was going on with her, she would say, fine. So Tony thought, you know what? I bet you 98% of the people that walk on the planet say they're fine when they're really not. So she decided to offer us a class project that we were to write about characters that lived in this place called Pepper Street, that said they were fine when they really weren't. So each different people wrote different scenes that we would put on in this acting class that Jean, her husband, was teaching. Jean Bua, you can look him up. He was also a master acting teacher, performer, composer, writer, everything plus, a big, huge personality, amazing, amazing man. And Tony and Jean were on a soap opera called Love of Life for 10 years where they met when she was 19 years old. They fell in love on screen, fell in love off screen, and got married. And they were married for 47 years before Jean passed away a year ago, November. So, back to Pepper Street. The play was about a young... Oh, so everybody wrote these different scenes, and it was about 8 hours long, you can only imagine, and with music. And Tony and a friend of mine, I invited a friend of mine who had a dream of building a theater and said, one day when I build a theater, I want this play to open my theater. So he went off and built his theater. Tony went off to write Pepper Street. She took all the scenes that different people wrote, and she rewrote them in such a way where they tied in with a storyline with music. 9 months later, interestingly enough, 9 months later, we opened Pepper Street at the Jean Bua Acting for Life Theater. No, at the Venture Theater. That was my friend's theater located on Hollywood Way in Burbank and Magnolia. And that's the theater, Nicole, by the way, that was opened up. The play itself was about a young girl, 17 years old, who felt like she was the black sheep. And she, of all these perfect people that lived in Pepper Street, so she decided to commit suicide, and she took drugs and alcohol and ended up in Heaven's waiting room, where she met her gorgeous Italian guardian angel named Angelo, who decided to convince her to go back to see the human side of these perfect people of Pepper Street. The whole thing was absolutely stunning with music and everything. We bussed in thousands of teens from halfway houses, residential treatment centers, and Boys and Girls Clubs, all of these teens that were disillusioned, that were at risk of losing their life because they were angry and so on. This play became a phenomenon and ran for 5 years, changing people's lives. We had post-production discussions with the actors coming out, talking about life, talking about issues that teens face, talking about why people would want to commit suicide and so on. Anyway, the storyline itself was a love story. She falls in love with Angelo, the angel, who's this gorgeous Italian guardian angel, you know, who convinces her to go back to the human side and see this these people and so on. So that's how I became involved with Tony and Jean at the beginning. Fast forward. January 11th, 2011, Tony was diagnosed with breast cancer. 12 years prior to that, Jean was diagnosed with Parkinson's. Tony had been taking care of him for all those years with Parkinson's, and then she got breast cancer. Somehow God brought me into that picture, almost like living with my friend who had the leukemia, and I became their life coach and their health advocate and helped set them up with their medical team, their off medical team, and just went the whole journey guiding them and coaching them and navigating them through this experience. A year ago, November, Jean became very ill with the Parkinson's and was no longer able to speak and was no longer able to move his body. And we created the most beautiful, sacred last days of his life here in their beautiful home. And he transitioned in this home, this beautiful home that they call Casa Bua. And all those years, for 40 years of their married life, they always had huskies. And in March, we had a tribute to Jean, and Tony, in one of her chemo treatments, mind you, wrote a play about Jean meeting this Angelo, the spirit and spirit in heaven. And we did a full-blown musical tribute to Jean's life using his song and this play that Tony wrote in March of last year with 375 people showing up. In June, the husky that they had together, Anushka, also transitioned. She just went out on the deck and she passed away in the night. And that was last June. So a friend of Tony's, fast forward, saw this YouTube video of Miley. And Tony's been through reconstructive surgery. She's been through chemo. She's been through radiation. She's been through a lot in the last 3 years, needless to say. And she said to her, "This is your dog." So Tony went online. She looked at it. We all cried when we saw this video. I mean, you cannot help but not cry.
Remember, yes.
Oh, my God. How could any, I don't know. That's a whole other story. How could anyone leave her? I don't know what the story was, but it was heartbreaking. So Tony wrote a letter, an email to Miley, to the dog, wanting to adopt her. Meanwhile, Tony was remodeling her kitchen, and that was another very important restructuring of Tony's life because it was healing the heart of her home and the heart of herself due to some childhood memories that did not sit well in the kitchen. She didn't even realize that's what was going on until we were, you know, diving deep to understand all the different steps that she was doing. That was a revelation and a beautiful realization, and her kitchen now is just so full of heart and warmth and openness that it reflects her beauty. And she talk about angels. I mean, when you were describing me, which I didn't think it was me, it sounded more like Tony, but I mean, she is definitely one of those angels that walk on this planet.
Yeah.
So then she had some friends who used their Twitter following of 50,000 people. Tracy Bregman, who's a beautiful actress on The Young and the Restless, who's also one of Tony's students and Jean's students, wrote to her followers, and they wrote to the Fuzzy Paws Foundation to on behalf of Tony's benefit to see if she couldn't adopt the dog. And then somebody else she knew, I mean, just different people out of the woodwork wrote letters. Well, it turns out the Fuzzy Paws Foundation, from these 13 million hits, got over 1,000 emails wanting to adopt the dog, 500 applications to adopt the dog, and they narrowed it down to 4 families. And they interviewed each of the family with the dog going to the home, and that happened about 3 weeks ago, I think it was. And two weeks ago Sunday, they called Tony and told her she got the dog. And then last Saturday, we had a shower for the dog where I made this big sign that said, "Welcome home, Miley." And Tony, in her finest crystal, in only the Tony way, put the dog treats in her finest crystal. He gave them to Miley. Well, Miley looks like Tony because she's all white. And Tony's hair is all white. And there is so much love in this house with this dog, Tony, and I just feel so blessed that again, Tony and Jean allowed me to be their life coach, because it's an honor and a privilege, and it's so sensitive to pierce one's ego. It's a delicate operation.
It is, and I love, we only have just, you know, a very brief time here, so I just wanted to make sure that I was able to thank you properly, but it's such a testament to you and your heart and your spirit and your soul, and the fact that as you are so kind, so generous to take time out of your day to share with us the Twilight Brigade and soul diving and all of the ways that we can live richer, fuller lives, and all the way we can transition in such a beautiful way and help those we love transition, and that we can, you know, end on a note of transition of this incredible little dog who was found on a trash pile, who now is in the arms and the home of one of the most loving people we know, and the fact that you were there in the center as a life coach and as a transition coach and as an angel of healing and love and joyousness and beauty and magic and all of these incredible things. And I'm just so blessed that you are with us today. And for all of you that are listening, whatever stage you are at in your life, as we were talking about, whether you're bumping into walls and spinning about or walking around like those little wind-up toys and just keep falling off the table, or if your life is going splendidly and you're looking to fly and you're looking to soar because you know flying and soaring is possible, or if you're at the end of your life or you have a family member or a loved one at the end of their life and you want to help them transition in the most beautiful, special, sacred way possible, that's all about the joy and the understanding and the oneness of the all that is, contact Shelley. And so, Shelley, once more, your website?
You can go to Whole Life Coaching and Beyond. And then look for Soul Diving Institute because it's coming.
Okay. And we so appreciate you being with us today. And my love to Tony and to Miley and certainly to you for the wonderful work you're doing in the world and with each and every individual that you meet.
Thank you so much, Nicole, for having me on the show. Thank you. Thank you so much. I feel so humbled and I felt like I was a little self-indulgent almost talking so much about myself.
Oh, my gosh. We love having you on the show because lights are meant to shine brightly. And you, my dear, are a bright, bright light. So much love and joy.
Thank
and we look forward to having you on again. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, darling. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Wow. What a wonderful, wonderful guest. What a wonderful gift. Miley the dog is in a loving, sacred, beautiful home for all of you that are following her stories. We'll bring Tony Bue on. I would love to have her as a guest and to talk about her magical journey because what a special person she is. And next week we have such an extraordinary show, totally different gear. We have Doug Walsh, and he is Get My Talk. So if you've ever been somewhere and there's a speaker and they download the presentation right into your phone, or if you've ever wanted information that you've seen something, heard something, you want to know how do you get that app, how do you get that in your phone, his technology is amazing. And I can honestly say he is one of the nicest people I have ever, ever, ever met. And the fact that he has this technological knowledge and that he knows how to do something, bam, if you want to get something from the universe, from the world, from something you've seen, something you've heard, and you want it instantaneously in your phone, in your computer, in your life, in your knowledge, he's going to teach us how to do that. So that is next Saturday on Unlimited Life, Doug Walsh. And I want to thank Shelley Wizen for being with us today. And as always, our show producers, this is Nicole Brandon with Unlimited Life. And we look forward to seeing you next week.